The troopers in the rear trotted up to the cart, met with their comrades, and all four turned to look up. There was some discussion, and two riders trotted back along the road.
"Oh, darn," said Polly. "What have they spotted?"
The horsemen went past their hiding place. A few moments later, they heard the horses enter the woods.
"Do we run and get them?" said Jade.
"Let Jackram do that," said Maledict.
"But if he does, and the men don't come back," Polly began.
"When they don't come back," Maledict corrected her.
"Then those other two will get suspicious, won't they? One will probably stay here, the other will go to get help."
"Then we'll sneak up and wait," said Maledict. "Look, they've dismounted. The cart's pulled in, too. If they look as though they're worried, we'll move in."
"And do what, exactly?" said Polly.
"Threaten to shoot them," said Maledict firmly.
"And if they don't believe us?"
"Then we'll threaten to shoot them in a much louder voice," said Maledict. "Happy? And I hope to hell they've got some coffee."
There are three things a soldier wants to do when there's a respite on the road. One involves lighting a cigarette, one involves lighting a fire, and the other one involves no flames at all, but does generally require a tree. Actually, a tree is not technically required, but seems to be insisted upon for reasons of style. The two troopers had a fire going and a billy can steaming, when a young man jumped down from the cart, stretched his arms, looked around, yawned, and sauntered a little way into the forest. He found a convenient tree and, a moment later, was apparently examining the bark at eye height with studied enthusiasm. The tip of a steel crossbow bolt pressed against the back of his neck, and a voice said, "Raise your hands and turn around slowly."
"What? Right now?"
All right, no. You can finish what you're doing."
"Actually, I think that's going to be quite impossible. Let me just, right. Okay."
The man raised his hands again.
"You realize I just have to shout?"
"So," said Polly, "I just have to pull this trigger. Shall we have a race?" The man turned around.
"See?" said Polly, stepping back. "It's him again, de Word, the writer man."
"You're them," he said.
"Them who?"
said Jade.
"Oh, dear," said Maledict.
"Look, I'd give anything to talk to you," said de Word.
"Please?"
"You're with the enemy," hissed Polly.
"What?
Them? No. They're from Lord Rust's regiment, from Ankh-Morpork. They've been sent to protect us."
"Troops to protect you in Borogravia?" said Maledict. "Who from?"
"You mean from whom?"
Well, you, in theory."
Jade leaned down.
"Efficient, aren't they?"
"Look, I must talk to you," said the man urgently. "This is astounding. Everyone's looking for you. Did you kill that old couple in the woods?"
Birds sang. Far off there was the call of the female blue-capped woodpecker.
"A patrol found the fresh graves," said de Word. High above, an ice heron, a winter migrant from the hub, gave an ugly honk as it searched for lakes.
"I take it you didn't, then?" said de Word.
"We buried them," said Maledict coldly. "We don't know who killed them."
"We did take some vegetables," said Polly. She remembered laughing about it. Admittedly, it was only because it was that or start crying, but even so. "You've been living off the land."
He tugged a notebook out of his pocket and was scribbling in it with a pencil.
"We don't have to talk to you," said Maledict.
"No, no, you must. There's so much you need to know. You're in the ups and downs, right?"
"Ins and outs," said Polly. "And you," the man began.
"I've had enough of this," said Maledict, and marched away from the tree and into the clearing. The two cavalrymen looked up from their fire, and there was a moment of immobility before one reached for his sword. Maledict swung the bow quickly from one to the other, its point hypnotizing them like a swinging watch.
"I've only got one shot, but there's two of you," he said. "Who shall I shoot? You choose. Now listen very carefully. Where's your coffee? You've got coffee, haven't you? Come on, everyone's got coffee. Spill the beans."
They stared at the crossbow and slowly shook their heads.
"What about you, writer man?" snarled Maledict. "Where are you hiding the coffee?"
"We only have cocoa," said the writer, raising his hands quickly as Maledict turned on him. "You're welcome to—"
Maledict dropped his crossbow, which fired straight up into the air, and failed to hit anything, especially a duck. This is so unusual in situations like this that it should be reported under new humour regulations.
If it had hit a duck, which quacked and then landed on somebody's head, this would of course been very droll, and would certainly have been reported. Instead, it drifted in the breeze a little and landed in an oak tree some 30 feet away, where it missed a squirrel. Maledict sat down with his head in his hands. "We're all gonna die," he said. The troopers shifted as though to stand up, and Jade raised her sapling.
"Don't even think about it," she said.
Polly turned to the writer man. "You want us to talk to you, sir? Then you talk to us. Is this about Prince Heinrich's socks?" Maledict stood up in one mad movement. "I say we grease the lot of them and go home," he said to no one in particular. "One, two, three, what are we fighting for?"
"Socks," said the writer, looking nervously at the vampire. "What have socks got to do with it?"
"I just gave you an order, Polly," said Maledict.
"What is it you think we don't know?" Polly insisted, glaring at Deward.
"Well, to start with, you're just about all that's left of the ins and outs."
"That's not true."
"Oh, there's prisoners and wounded, I think. But why should I lie to you?
Why did he call you Polly?"
"Because I know a lot about birds," said Polly, mentally cursing. "How do you know what's been happening to the regiment?"
"Because it's my job to know things," said the man.
"What's that bird up there?"
Polly glanced up.
"I don't have time for stupid games," she said. "And that's a—"
She stopped. Something was wheeling high above in the forbidden blue.
"You don't know?" said De Word.
"Yes, of course I know," said Polly irritably. "It's a white-necked buzzard. But I thought they never came this far into the mountains. I only ever saw one in a book."
She raised her bow again and tried to take control.
"Am I right, Mr. It's My Job to Know Things?"
De Word raised his hands again and gave her a sickly smile.
"Probably," he said. "I live in a city. I know sparrows from starlings. After that, everything's a duck as far as I'm concerned."
Polly glared at him.
"Look, please," said the man. "You need to listen to me. You need to know things before it's too late."
Polly lowered the bow.
"If you want to talk to us, wait here," she said. "Corporal, we are leaving. Carborundum, pick up those troopers."
"Hold it," said Maledict. "Who's the corporal in his squad?"
"You are," said Polly. "And you're drooling and swaying, and your eyes look weird. So what was your point, please?"
Maledict considered this. Polly was tired and frightened, and somewhere inside this was all being transmuted into anger. Hers was not an expression you wanted to see at the far end of a crossbow. An arrow couldn't kill a vampire, but that didn't mean it didn't hurt.
"You're right," he said. "Carborundum, pick up those troopers. We are leaving."
There was a bird whistle as Polly neared the hiding place. She identified this one as the sound of a very bad bird impersonator, and made a note to teach the girls some bird calls that at least sounded real. They were harder to do than most people thought. The squad were in the gully, armed and at least looking dangerous. There was a certain amount of relaxation when they saw Jade carrying the two bound troopers. Two more were sitting disconsolately against the cliff, hands tied behind them. Maledict walked smartly up to Blouse and saluted.
"Two prisoners, LT, and Perks thinks there's someone down there you ought to talk to."
He leaned forward.
"The newspaper man, sir."
"Then we'll jolly well keep well away from him, then," said Blouse. "Eh, Sergeant?"
"Right, sir," said Jackram. "Nothing but trouble, sir."
Polly saluted madly. "Please, sir, permission to speak, sir."
"Yes, Perks," said Blouse.
Polly saw there was one chance and one only. She had to find out about Paul. Now her mind worked as fast as it had on the hill last night, when she'd gone for the man with the code book.
"Sir, I don't know if he's worth talking to, sir, but he may be worth listening to, even if you think he'll only tell us lies, because sometimes, sir, the way people tell you lies, if they tell you enough lies, well, they sort of show you what shape the truth is, sir. And we don't have to tell him the truth, sir. We could lie to him, too."
"I'm not by nature an untruthful man, Perks," said Blouse coldly.
"Glad to hear it, sir. Are we winning the war, sir?"
"You stop that right now, Perks," Jackram roared.
"It was only a question, Sarge," said Polly reproachfully.
Around the clearing the squad waited, ears sucking up every sound. Everyone knew the answer. They waited for it to be said aloud.
"Perks, this kind of talk spreads despondency," Blouse began. But he said it as if he didn't believe it and didn't care who knew.
"No, sir, it doesn't really. It's better than being lied to," said Polly.
She changed her voice, gave it that edge her mother used to use on her when she was being scolded.
It's evil to lie. No one likes a liar. Tell me the truth, please.
Some harmonic of that must have had a home in an old part of Blouse's brain. As Jackram opened his mouth to roar, the lieutenant held up a hand.
We are not winning, Perks, but we have not lost yet.
I think we all know that, sir, but it's good to hear you say it, said Polly, giving him an encouraging smile. That seemed to work too.
I suppose there's no harm in at least being civil to the wretched fellow, said Blouse, as if thinking aloud. He may give away valuable information under cunning questioning.
Polly looked at Sergeant Jackram, who was staring upwards like a man in prayer.
"Permission to be the man to interrogate the gentleman, sir," said the sergeant.
"Permission denied, sergeant," said Blouse. "I'd like him to live, and I don't want to lose another lobe. However, you may take Perks back to the cart and drive it up here."
Jackram gave him the smart salute. Polly had already learned to recognize it. It meant that Jackram had already made plans.
"Very good, sir," he said. "Come on, Perks."
Jackram was quiet as they walked back down over the needle-carpeted slope. Then, after a while, he said,
"Do you know why them troopers found our little nook, Perks?"
"No, Sarge."
"The lieutenant ordered Shufti to put out the fire immediately. It wasn't as if there was even any smoke. So Shufti goes and pours the kettle on it."
Polly gave this a few seconds' thought.
"Steam, Sarge."
"Right, in a bloody great rising cloud. Not Shufti's fault. The gallopers weren't any trouble, though. Bright enough not to try to outrun half a dozen crossbows, at least. That's clever for a cavalryman."
"Well done, Sarge."
"Don't talk to me as if I was a Rupert lad," said Jackram easily.
"Sorry, Sarge."
"I see you're learning how to steer an officer, though. You got to make sure they gives you the right orders, see? You'll make a good sergeant, Perks."
"Don't want to, Sarge."
"Yeah, right," said Jackram.
It could have meant anything.
After watching the track for a minute or two, they stepped out and headed toward the cart. De Word was sitting on a stool beside it, writing in a notebook, but he stood up hurriedly when he saw them.
"It'll be a good idea to get off the track," he said, as soon as they approached. "There are a lot of patrols, I understand."
"Slovenian patrols, sir," said Jackram.
"Yes. In theory, this," he pointed to the flag that hung limply from the cart, "should keep us safe. But everyone's a bit jumpy at the moment."
"Aren't you Sergeant Jack Ram?"
"Jackram, sir, and I'll thank you for not writing my name down in your little book, sir."
"Sorry, Sergeant, but that's my job," said De Word breezily. "I have to write things down."
"Well, sir, soldiering's my job," said Jackram,
climbing onto the cart and gathering up the reins.
"But you'll note how at this moment in time I'm not killing you. Let's go, eh?"
Polly climbed into the back of the cart as it lumbered off. It was full of boxes and equipment, and while it may once have been neatly organized, that organization was now but a distant memory, a clear indication that this cart was the property of a man. Next to her, half a dozen of the largest pigeons she'd ever seen dozed on a perch in their wire cage, and she wondered if they were a living larder. One of them opened one eye and lazily went, "Lululup," which is pigeon for "duh." Most of the rest of the boxes had labels like, she leaned closer, "Captain Horace Calumny's Patent Field Biscuits" and "Dried Stew." As she was musing that Shufti would have very much liked to get her hands on one or two of these boxes, a bundle of clothes hanging from the ceiling of the rocking cart moved slightly and a face appeared.
"Good morning,"
it said upside down. William De Word turned around on the seat in front.
"It's only Otto, Private," he said. "Don't be afraid."
"Yes, I will not bite," said the face cheerfully.
It smiled. A vampire's face does not look any better upside down, and a smile in these circumstances does nothing to improve matters.
"That is guaranteed."
Polly lowered the crossbow. Jackram would have been impressed at how quickly she had raised it. So was she, and embarrassed too. The socks were doing the thinking again. Otto very elegantly lowered himself to the bed of the cart.
"Where are we going?"
he said, steadying himself as they bounced over a rut.
"A little place I know, sir," said Jackram. "Nice and quiet."
"Good. I need to exercise the imps," said the vampire. "They get fretful if they are cooped up for too long."
Otto pushed aside a stack of paper and revealed his large picture-making box. He lifted a small hatch.
"Rise and shine, lads," he said.
There was a chorus of high-pitched voices from inside.
"I'd better just give you the heads-up, re-tiger, Mr. De Word," said Jackram as the cart rolled up an old logging track.
"Tiger?
Who's Tiger?
Oops, said Jackram. Sorry, that's what we call the lieutenant, sir, on account of him being so brave. Forget I said that, will you?
Brave, is he? Said the word.
And clever, sir. Don't let him fool you, sir. He is one of the great military minds of his generation, sir.
Polly's mouth dropped open. She'd suggested they liked the man, but this...
Really? Then why is he just a lieutenant? Said the writer.
Ah, I can see there's no fooling you, sir, said Jackram, oozing knowingness.
Yes, it's a puzzler, sir, why he calls himself a lieutenant. Still, I dare say he has his reasons, eh?
Just like Heinrich calling himself a captain, right? He tapped the side of his nose.
I see everything, sir, and I don't say a word.
All I could find out was that he did some kind of desk job at your HQ, sergeant, said the word.
Polly saw him taking his notebook out slowly and carefully.
"Yes, I expect that what you would find out, sir," said Jackram with a huge conspiratorial wink. "And then, when things are at their worst, they let him out, sir. They unleash him, sir. Me, I don't know a thing, sir."
"What does he do? Explode?" said the word.
"Ha-ha-ha! Nice one, sir," said Jackram. "No, sir, what he does, sir, is assess situation, sir. I don't understand it myself, sir, not being a big thinker. But the proof of the pudding, sir, is in the eating of same. And last night we were jumped by 8 20 Slovenian troopers, sir. And the lieutenant just assessed the situation in a flash and skewered 5 of the buggers, sir. Like a kebab, sir. Mild as milk to look at, but rouse him and he's a whirlwind of death. Of course you did not hear it from me, sir.
And he's in charge of a bunch of recruits, sergeant, said the word. That doesn't sound very likely to me.
"Recruits who captured some crack cavalrymen, sir," said Jackram, looking pained. "That's leadership for you. Comes the hour, comes the man, sir. I'm just a simple old soldier, sir. Seen 'em come, seen 'em go. Upon my oath I am not a lying man, sir, but I look at Lieutenant Blows in wonderment."
"He just seemed confused to me," said the word, but there was a hint of uncertainty in his voice.
"That was a bit of concussion, sir. He took a wallop that would have felled a lesser man, and still got back onto his feet. Amazing, sir."
Said the word, making a note.
The cart splashed across the shallow little stream and rocked into the gully. Lieutenant Blows was sitting on a rock. He'd made an effort, but his tunic was grubby, his boots were muddy, his hand was swollen, and one ear, despite Igorina's attentions, was still inflamed. He had his sword on his knees.
Jackram carefully brought the cart to a halt by a thicket of birch trees. All 4 of the enemy troopers were tied up against the cliff. Apart from them, the camp appeared to be deserted.
"Where are the rest of the men, sergeant?" whispered de Word as he slid down off the cart.
"Oh, they're around, sir," said Jackram, "watching you. Probably not a good idea to make any sudden moves, sir."
No one else was visible. And then Maledict faded into view.
People never really looked at things, Polly knew. They glanced, and what had been a patch of scrub was now Corporal Maledict. Polly stared. He'd cut a hole in the centre of his old blanket, and the mud and grass stains on the mildewed greyness had turned him into part of the landscape until he saluted. He'd also stuck leafy twigs all over his hat. Sergeant Jackram goggled. Polly had never really seen proper goggling before, but the sergeant had the face to do it at a championship level. She could feel him drawing breath while at the same time assembling cuss words for a right royal thundering. And then he remembered he was playing Sergeant Big Jolly Fat Man, and this was not the time to segue into Sergeant Incandescent.
"Lads, eh?" he chuckled to de Word. "What will they think of next?"
De Word nodded nervously, pulled a wad of newspapers from under his seat, and advanced on the lieutenant.
"Mr. De Word, isn't it?" said Blau, standing up. "Perks, can we manage a cup of, saloop for Mr. De Word? There's a good chap. Do take a rock, sir."
"Good of you to see me, lieutenant," said De Word. "It looks as though you've been in the wars," he added, with an attempt at joviality.
"No, only this one," said Blau, looking puzzled.
"I meant that you have been wounded, sir," said De Word.
"These? Oh, they're nothing, sir. I'm afraid the one on my hand was self-inflicted. Sword drill, you know."
"You're left-handed, then, sir?"
"Oh, no."
Polly, washing out a mug, heard Jackram say out of the corner of his mouth,
"Should have seen the other 2 fellows, sir."
"Are you aware of the progress of the war, lieutenant?" said De Word.
"You tell me, sir," said Blouse. "All your army is bottled up in the Kinnec Valley, dug in mostly, just beyond the reach of the Keep's weaponry. Your forts elsewhere along the border have been captured. The garrisons at Drurp and Glitz and Arblat have been overwhelmed. As far as I can tell, Lieutenant, your squad are the only soldiers still at large. At least," he added, "the only ones still fighting." "And my regiment?" said Blouse quietly. "The remnant of the 10th took part in a brave but, frankly, suicidal attempt to retake Kinnec Keep a few days ago, sir. Most of the survivors are prisoners of war, and I have to tell you that almost all your high command have been captured. They were in the keep when it was taken. There are big dungeons in that fort, sir, and they're pretty full." "Why should I believe you?"
"I do," thought Polly.
"So, Paul is either dead, wounded, or captured. And it doesn't help much to think of it as 2 chances in 3 that he is alive." De Word threw his newspapers at the lieutenant's feet. "It's all there, sir. I didn't make it up. It's the truth. It will remain true whether you believe it or not. There are more than 6 countries ranged against you, including Genua and Moldavia and Ankh-Morpork. There is no one on your side. You are alone. The only reason you're not beaten yet is because you won't admit it. I've seen your generals, sir, great leaders, and your men fight like demons, but they won't surrender." "Borogravia doesn't know the meaning of the word surrender, Mr. De Word," said the lieutenant. "May I loan you a dictionary, sir?" snapped De Word, going red in the face. "It's very similar to the meaning of the word making some kind of peace while you've still got a chance, sir. It's rather like the word quitting while you've still got a head, sir. Good heavens, sir, don't you understand? The reason that there still is an army in Kinnec Valley is that the Allies haven't yet decided what to do with it. They're fed up with the slaughter." "Ah, so we still fight back," said Blouse. De Word sighed. "You don't understand, sir. They are fed up with slaughtering you. They've got the keep now. There's some big war engines up there. They... frankly, sir, some of the Alliance would just as soon wipe out the remains of your army. It'd be like shooting rats in a barrel. They have you at their mercy, and yet you keep on attacking. You attack the keep. It's on sheer rock, and it's got walls 100 feet high. You make salients across the river. You're bottled up, and you've got nowhere to go, and the Allies could simply massacre you any time they want, and you act as if you're just facing some kind of temporary setback. That's what's really happening, Lieutenant. You are just a last little detail." "Have a care, please," Blouse warned. "Excuse me, sir, but do you know anything about recent history? In the past 30 years, you have declared war on every single one of your neighbours at least once. All countries fight, but you brawl. And then last year you invaded Slovenia again."
"They invaded us, Mr. De Word."
"You have been misinformed, Lieutenant. You invaded the Kinnec province."
"That was confirmed as Borogravian by the Treaty of Lint more than 100 years ago.
"Signed at sword point, sir. And no one cares now, in any case. It's all got beyond your stupid little royal scuffles. Because your men tore down the Grand Trunk, you see, the Clax Towers, and tore up the coach road. Ankh-Morpork regards that as bandit activity."
"Have a care, I said," said Blouse. "I note you are displaying the Ankh-Morpork flag with evident pride on your wagon."
"Civis Morporcias sum, sir. I am an Ankh-Morpork citizen. You could say that Ankh-Morpork shelters me under her wide and rather greasy wing, although I agree the metaphor could use some work."
"Your Ankh-Morpork soldiers aren't in a position to protect you, however."
"Sir, you are right. You could have me killed right now," said De Word simply. "You know that. I know that. But you won't, for 3 reasons. The officers of Borogravia tend towards honour. Everyone says that. That's why they don't surrender. And I bleed most distressingly. And you don't need to, because everyone's interested in you. Suddenly it's all changed."
"Interested in us?"
"Sir, in a sense you could help a lot right now. Apparently, people back in Ankh-Morpork were amazed when... Look, have you heard about what we call
human interest, sir.
No.
De Worde tried to explain. Blouse listened with his mouth open, and at the end said,
Have I got this right? Although many people have been killed and wounded in this wretched war, it's not been of much interest to your readers. But it is now just because of us. Because of a little skirmish in a town they never heard of. And because of that, we're suddenly a plucky little country, and people are telling your newspaper that your great city should be on our side.
Yes, Lieutenant. We put out a second edition last night, you see, after I'd found out that Captain Horrence was really Prince Heinrich. Did you know this at the time, sir?
Of course not, snapped Blouse.
And you, Private, Perks, would you have kicked him in the, would you have kicked him had you known?
Polly dropped a mug in her nervousness and looked at Blouse.
You may answer, of course, Perks, said the Lieutenant.
Well, yes, sir, I would have kicked him. Harder, probably. I was defending myself, sir, Polly said, carefully avoiding further details. You couldn't be sure what someone like De Worde would do with them.
Right, good, yes, said De Worde. Then you might be pleased with this. Our cartoonist, Fizz, drew this for the special edition. It was on the front page. We've sold a record number of copies.
He handed her a flimsy piece of paper, which by the look of the creases had been folded many times. It was a line drawing with lots of shading. It showed a huge figure with a large sword, a monstrous monocle, and a moustache as wide as a coat hanger, menacing a much smaller figure armed with nothing more than an instrument for lifting beets. In fact, there was a beet stuck on the end of it. At least, that was clearly what had been happening, right up to the point when the smaller figure, wearing a not-a-bad attempt at an ins-and-outs shako and a face that slightly looked like Polly's, had kicked the other one squarely in the groinal regions. A sort of balloon was coming out of Polly's mouth, containing the words, "That's for your royal prerogative, you blackguard." The balloon issuing from the mouth of the ogre, who could only be Prince Heinrich, said, "Oh, my succession, that such a small thing could hurt so much." And in the background, a fat woman in a rumpled ball gown and a huge old-fashioned helmet was clasping her hands to an unbelievably large bosom, staring at the fight with a mixture of concern and admiration, and ballooning, "Oh, my swain, I fear our liaison is cut short." Since no one else was saying much, but was simply staring, De Worde said, rather nervously, "Fizz is rather, direct in these matters, but amazingly popular." "You see, the curious thing is that although Ankh-Morpork is probably the biggest bully around, in a subtle kind of way, we nevertheless have a soft spot for people who stand up to bullies, especially royal ones. We tend to be on their side, provided it doesn't cost us too much." Blouse cleared his throat.
"It's quite a good likeness of you, Perks," he said hoarsely.
"I only use my knee, sir," Polly protested, "and that fat lady certainly wasn't there."
"That's Morpork here," said De Worde. "She's a sort of representation of the city, except that, in her case, she's not covered in mud and soot."
"And I have to add for my part," said Blouse, in his talking-to-a-meeting voice, "that Borogravia is in fact larger than Slovenia, although most of the country is little more than barren mountainside."
"That doesn't actually matter," said De Worde.
"It doesn't?" said Blouse.
"No, sir. It's just a fact. It's not politics. In politics, sir, pictures like this are powerful."
"Sir, even the Alliance commanders are talking about you, and the Slovenians are angry and bewildered. If you, the heroes of the hour, could make a plea for a little common sense..."
The lieutenant took a long, deep breath.
"This is a foolish war, Mr. De Worde, but I am a soldier. I have kissed the Duchess, as we say. It's an oath of loyalty. Don't tempt me to break it. I must fight for my country. We will repel all invaders. If there are deserters, we will find them and rally them again. We know the country. While we are free, Borogravia will be free. You have had your say. Thank you. Where is that tea, Perks?"
"What? Oh, nearly done, sir," said Polly, turning back to the fire.
It had been a sudden strange fancy, but a stupid plan.
Now, out here, all the drawbacks were visible. How would she have got Paul home? Would he have wanted to come? Could she have managed it? Even if he was still alive, how could she hope to get him out of a prison? "So you'll be guerrilla fighters, eh?" said Mr. de Word behind her. "Madmen, all of you." "No, we are not irregulars," said Blouse. "We kiss the Duchess. We are soldiers." "Oh, well," said de Word. "Then I admire your spirit at least." "Ah, Otto." The vampire iconographer ambled up and gave them a shy smile.
"Do not be afraid. I am a black ribboner, just like your corporal," he said. "Light is my passion now."
"Oh, well done," said Blouse.
"Take the pictures, Otto," said de Word. "These gentlemen have a war to fight."
"Out of interest, Mr. de Word," Blouse interrupted, "how did you get the pictures back to your city so quickly? Magic, I assume?"
"What?" De Word looked momentarily off balance.
"Oh, no, sir. Wizards are expensive, and Commander Vimes has said that there is going to be no first use of magic in this war. We send things by pigeon to our office in the keep, and then by clacks from the nearest trunk tower."
"Oh, really?" said Blouse, showing rather more animation than Polly had seen up to now.
"Using numbers to indicate a scale of grey shades, perhaps?"
"Mein Gott!" said Otto.
"Well, yes, as a matter of fact, we do," said de Word. "I'm very impressed at you."
"I have seen the Clax Towers on the far bank of the Kinnick," said Blouse, his eyes lighting up. "Very clever idea, using big shuttered boxes rather than the old-fashioned semaphore arms. And would I be right in my surmise that the box on the top, which opens its shutters once a second, is a kind of system, a clock, that makes certain the whole Clax line keeps in step?"
"Oh, good. Thought so. One beat a second is probably the limit of the mechanisms, so no doubt all your efforts now are concentrated on maximizing the information content per shutter operation?"
"Yes, I imagine that would be the case. As for sending pictures, well, sooner or later all things are numbers, yes?"
"Now, of course, you would use each of the two columns of four boxes to send a grey code, but it must be very slow. Have you considered a squeezing algorithm?"
De Word and Huyck exchanged a glance.
"Are you sure you haven't been talking to anyone about this, sir?" said the writer.
"Oh, it's all very elementary," said Blouse, smiling happily. "I had thought about it in the context of military maps, which are, of course, mostly white space. So I wondered if it would be possible to indicate a required shade on one column, and on the other side indicate how far along that rank that shade would persist. And a delightful bonus here is that if your map was simply in black and white, then you have even more."
"You haven't seen inside a Clax Tower, have you?" said de Word.
"Alas, no," said Blouse. "This is simply thinking aloud based on the de facto existence of your picture. I believe I can see a number of other little mathematical tricks to make the passage of information even swifter, but I'm sure these have already occurred to you. And, of course, a fairly minor modification could potentially double the information burden of the whole system at a stroke. And, of course, that is without using coloured filters at night, which I'm certain, even with the overhead of extra mechanical effort, would surely increase throughput by... I'm sorry, did I say something wrong?"
The two men wore a glazed expression. De Word shook himself.
No, nothing, he said. "And you seem to have got the grasp of things very quickly."
"Though it was quite straightforward once I started thinking about it," said Blouse. "It was exactly the same when I had to redesign the department's filing system, you see. People build themselves something that works. Then circumstances change, and they have to tinker with it to make it continue to work. And they are so busy tinkering that they cannot see that a much better idea would be to build a whole new system to deal with the new circumstances. But to an outsider, the idea is obvious."
"In politics as well as, filing systems and claxes, do you think?" said de Word.
Blouse's brow wrinkled.
"I'm sorry, I don't think I follow," he said.
"Would you agree that sometimes a country's system is so out of date that it's only the outsiders that can see the need for wholesale change?" said de Word.
He smiled. Lieutenant Blouse did not.
"Just a point to ponder, maybe," said de Word. "Since you wish to tell the world of your defiance, would you object if my colleague takes your picture?"
Blouse shrugged.
"If it gives you any satisfaction," he said.
It's an abomination, of course, but these days it's hard to find something that isn't. You must tell the world, Mr. De Word, that Borogravia won't lie down. We will not give in. We will fight on. Write that down in your little notebook, please. While we can stand, we will kick.
Yes, but once again, may I implore you to...
Mr. De Word, you have, I am sure, heard the saying that the pen is mightier than the sword.
De Word preened a little.
Of course, and I... Do you want to test it? Take your picture, sir, and then my men will escort you back to your road.
Otto Schreek stood up and bowed to Blouse. He unslung his picture box.
This will only take 1 minute, he said.
It never does. But Polly watched in horrified fascination as Otto took picture after picture of Lieutenant Blouse in a variety of what the lieutenant thought were heroic poses. It is a terrible thing to see a man trying to jut out a chin he does not, in fact, have.
"Very impressive," said De Word. "I just hope you live to see it in my paper, sir."
"I shall look forward to it with the keenest anticipation," said Blouse.
"And now, Perks, please go along with the sergeant and put these two gentlemen back on their way."
Otto sidled up to Polly as they walked back to the cart.
"I need to tell you something about your vampire," he said.
"Oh, yes?"
"You are a friend of his?" said Otto.
"Yes," said Polly. "Is something wrong?"
"There is a problem."
He's got twitchy because he's run out of coffee.
Alas, if only it was that simple,
Otto looked awkward.
You have to understand that when a vampire forgoes the B word, there is a process that we call transference. They force themselves to desire something else. For me, this was not painful. I crave the perfection of light and shade. Pictures are my life, but your friend chose coffee. And now he has none.
Oh, I see.
I wonder if you do. It probably seemed so sensible to him. It is a human craving, and no one minds if you say, as it might be, I'm dying for a cup of coffee, or I'd kill for a cup of coffee. But without coffee, he will, I'm afraid, revert. Do you understand, this is very difficult for me to talk about.
Otto trailed off.
By revert. You mean? First, he'll come mild delusions, I think. A psychic susceptibility to all kinds of influences from who knows where, and vampires can hallucinate so strongly that they can be contagious. I think that is happening already. He will become erratic. This may last for several days, and then his conditioning will break and he will be once again a true vampire. No more Mr. Nice Coffee Drinker Guy.
Can't I do anything to help him? Otto reverentially laid his picture box in the back of the cart and turned to her.
You can find him some coffee, or you can keep a wooden stake and a big knife ready. You would be doing him a favour, believe me.
I can't do that.
Otto shrugged. Find someone who will.
He is amazing, said De Word as the cart rocked back down through the trees. I know the Clax is against your religion, but he seems to understand all about it.
Like I said, sir, he assesses stuff, said Jackram, beaming. Mind like a razor.
He was talking about Clax algorithms that the companies are only just now investigating, said De Word. That department he was talking about.
Ah, I can see nothing gets past you, sir, said Jackram. Very hush-hush. Can't talk about it.
To be frank, Sergeant, I'd always assumed that Borogravia was, well, backward. Jackram's smile was waxy and bright.
If we seem to be a long way back, sir, it's only so's we can get a good run-up.
You know, Sergeant, it's a great shame to see a mind like that wasted, said De Word as the cart lurched in a rut. This is not an age of heroes and famous last stands and death or glory charges. Do your men a favour and try to tell him that, will you?
Wouldn't dream of it, sir, said Jackram. Here is your road, sir. Where will you be heading now?
To Kneck Valley, Sergeant.
This is a good story, Sergeant. Thank you. Allow me to shake you by the hand. Glad to hear you think that, sir, said Jackram, extending his hand.
Polly heard the faint clink of coins in their passage from palm to palm. De Word took the reins.
But I must tell you, Sergeant, that we'll probably send off our stuff by pigeon within the hour, he said. We will have to say you have prisoners.
"'Don't worry about that, sir,' said Jackram. "'By the time their mates come out here to rescue these gallopers, we'll be halfway back to the mountains. Our mountains.' They parted. Jackram watched them out of sight and turned to Polly. "'Him with his airs and graces,' he said. "'Did you see that? He insulted me by giving me a tip.' He glanced at his palm. "'Hm! 5 Ankh Morpork dollars. Well, at least he's a man who knows how to insult you handsomely,' he added, and the coins disappeared into his jacket with remarkable speed.
"'I think he wants to help us, Sarge,' said Polly.
Jackram ignored that. "'I hate bloody Ankh Morpork,' he said. "'Who are they to tell us what to do? Who cares what they think?'
"'Do you think we can really join up with deserters, Sarge?'
"'Nope. They deserted once, what's to stop 'em a second time? They spat on the Duchess when they deserted. They can't kiss and make up now. You get one kiss, that's all.
But Lieutenant Blows—'
"'The Rupert should stick to his sums. He thinks he's a soldier. Never walked on a battlefield in his life. All that rubbish he gave your man was death or glory stuff. And I'll tell you, Perks, I've seen death more often than I care to remember, but I've never clapped eyes on glory. I'm all for sending the fools to look for us where we ain't, though.'
"'He's not my man, Sarge,' said Polly.
"'Yeah, well, you're at home with writing and reading,' grumbled Jackram. "'You can't trust the people who do that stuff. They mess around with the world, and it turns out everything you know is wrong.'
They reached the gully again. The squad had come back from their various hiding places, and most were clustered around one of the newspapers. For the first time, Polly saw the picture. It was actually quite good, especially of Shufti and Wazza. She was mostly hidden by the bulk of Jackram, but you could see the sullen cavalrymen behind them, and their expressions were a picture in themselves.
"'It's a good one of Tonka,' said Igorina, who didn't lisp so much when there were no officers to hear.
"'You think having a picture like this is an abomination unto Nuggan?' said Shufti nervously. "'Probably,' said Polly absent-mindedly. "'Most things are.' She ran her eye down the text next to the picture. It was full of phrases like "plucky farm boys" and "humiliation of some of Slovenia's best troops" and "sting in the tail." She could see why it had caused trouble. She rustled through the other pages. They were crammed with strange stories about places she'd never heard of and pictures of people she didn't recognize. But one page was a mass of grey text under a line of much bigger printing which read, "Why this mad state must be stopped." Bewildered, her eye picked up phrases from the sea of letters. "Disgraceful invasions of neighbouring states," "deluded worshippers of a mad god," "a strutting bully," "outrage after outrage," "flying in the face of international opinion."
"Don't you lads read that rubbish. You don't know where it's been," said Sergeant Jackram jovially, arriving behind them. "It'll all be lies. We are leaving right—" "Corporal Maledict!"
Maledict, emerging from the trees, gave a lazy salute. He was still wearing his blanket.
"What are you doing out of uniform?"
"I'm in uniform underneath, Sarge.
We don't want to be seen, right? Like this, we become part of the jungle." "It's a forest, Corporal, and without bloody uniforms, how the hell will we know our friends from our enemies?"
Maledict lit a cigarette before he replied.
"The way I see it, Sarge," he said, "the enemy is everyone but us."
"Just one moment, Sergeant," said Blows, who had looked up from a newspaper and had been watching the apparition with considerable interest. "There are precedents in antiquity, you know. General Song Sang Lo moved his army disguised as a field of sunflowers, and General Tacticus once commanded his battalion to dress as spruces."
"Sunflowers," said Jackram, his voice oozing with disdain.
"Both actions were successful, Sergeant."
"No uniforms? No badges? No stripes, sir?"
"Possibly you could be an extra-large bloom," said Blows, and his face betrayed no hint of amusement. "And you have surely carried out actions at night, when all markings are invisible?"
"Yes, sir, but night is night, sir. Well, sunflowers is sunflowers, sir. I've worn this uniform for more than all my life, sir, and sneaking around without a uniform is downright dishonourable. It's for spies, sir."
Jackram's face had gone beyond red into crimson, and Polly was amazed to see tears in the corners of his eyes. "How can we be spies, Sergeant, in our own country?" said Blows calmly.
"The LT's got a point, Sarge," said Maledict.
Jackram turned like a bull at bay, and then, to Polly's amazement, he sagged. But she wasn't amazed for long. She knew the man. She didn't know why, but there was something about Jackram that she could read. It was in the eyes. He could lie with eyes as honest and tranquil as those of an angel. And if he appeared to be backing away, it was indeed only to get a run-up later on.
All right," the sergeant said. "Upon my oath, I am not a man to disobey orders," and his eyes twinkled.
"Well done, sergeant," said Blouse.
Jackram pulled himself together. "I don't want to be a sunflower, though," he said.
"Happily, there are only fir trees in this area, sergeant."
"Point well made, sir." Jackram turned to the awed squad.
"All right, last detail," he bellowed. "You heard the man. Spruce up."
It was an hour later. As far as Polly could tell, they'd started out for the mountains, but had travelled in a wide semicircle, so that they ended up facing back the way they had come, but a few miles away. Was Blouse leading, or had he left it to Jackram? Neither man was complaining. The lieutenant called a halt in a thicket of birch, thus doubling the size of the thicket. You could say that the camouflage effects were effective, because bright red and white show up against greens and greys. Beyond that, though, language tended to run out. Jade had scraped off her paint, and was green and grey anyway. Igor looked like a walking brush. Wazza quivered like an aspen all the time, so her needles rustled permanently. The others had made more or less reasonable attempts, and Polly was pretty proud of her own efforts. Jackram was about as tree-like as a big red rubber ball. Polly suspected that he'd surreptitiously shined up his brasswork too. Every tree held a mug of tea in limb or hand. After all, they'd stopped for 5 minutes. "Men," said Blouse, as if he'd only just reached that conclusion, "you may have gathered that we are heading back toward the mountains to raise a deserter's army there. This story is, in fact, a ruse for the benefit of Mr. De Word." He paused, as if expecting some reaction. They stared at him. He went on. "We are, in fact, continuing our journey to the Kinnec Valley. This is the last thing the enemy will be expecting." Polly glanced at the sergeant. He was grinning. "It is an established fact that a small, light force can get into places that a battalion cannot penetrate," Blouse went on. "Men, we'll be that force. Is that not right, Sergeant Jackram?"
"Yes, sir." "We will come down like a hammer on those forces smaller than us," said Blouse happily. "Yes, sir." "And from those that outnumber us, we will merge silently into the forest." "Yes, sir." "We will slip past their sentries." "That's right, sir," said Jackram. "And take Kinnec Keep from under their noses."
Jackram's tea sprayed across the clearing.
"I dare say our enemy feels impregnable, just because he commands a heavily armed fort on a rocky crag with walls 100 feet high and 20 feet thick," Blouse continued, as if half the trees weren't now dripping tea. "But he is in for a surprise."
"You are right, Sarge," whispered Polly. Jackram was making strange little noises in his throat.
"Does anyone have any questions?" said Blouse. Igorina raised a branch.
"How will we get in, Far?" she said.
"Ah, good question," said Blouse. "All will become apparent in due time."
"Aerial cavalry," said Maledict.
"Pardon, Corporal?"
"Flying machines, sir," said Maledict. "They won't know where to expect us. We touch down in a handy LZ, take them out, and then dust off."
Blouse's clear brow wrinkled a little.
"Flying machine?" he said. "I saw a picture of one by someone called Leonard of Quorum. A sort of flying windmill. It's just like a big screw up in the sky." "I don't think we need one of those, although the advice is welcome," said Blouse.
"Not when we've got a big screw up down here, sir," Jackram managed. "Sir, this is just a bunch of recruits, sir. All that stuff about honour and freedom and that was just for the writer man, right?" "Good idea, sir, yeah. Let's get to Kinnec Valley. Let's sneak in and join the rest of the lads. That's where we ought to be, sir. You can't be serious about taking the keep, sir. I wouldn't try that with 1,000 men.
"I might try it with 6, sergeant."
Jackram's eyes bulged.
"Really, sir? What'll Private Goom do? Tremble at them? Young Igor will stitch him up, will he? Private Halter will give him a nasty look? They're promising lads, sir, but they're not men."
General Tacticus said the fate of a battle may depend upon the actions of one man in the right place, Sergeant, said Blouse calmly.
And having a lot more soldiers than the other bugger, sir, Jackram insisted. Sir, we should get to the rest of the army. Maybe it's trapped, maybe it isn't. All that stuff about them not wanting to slaughter us, sir, that makes no sense. The idea is to win, sir. If the rest of them have stopped attacking, it's because they're frightened of us. We should be down there. That's the place for young recruits, sir, where they can learn. The enemy is looking for them, sir.
If General Frock is among those captured, the keep will be where he is held, said Blouse. I believe he was the first officer you served under as a sergeant, am I right?
Jackram hesitated. That's right, sir, he said eventually. And he was the dumbest lieutenant I've ever met, bar one.
I am positive there is a secret entrance into the keep, sergeant.
Polly's memory nudged her. If Paul was alive, he was in the keep. She caught Shufti's eye. The girl nodded. She'd been thinking along the same lines. She didn't talk much about her fiancé, and Polly wondered how official the arrangement was.
Permission to speak, Sarge, she said.
Okay, Perks.
I'd like to find a way into the keep, Sarge.
Perks, are you volunteering to attack the biggest, strongest castle within 500 miles, single-handed?
I'll go too, said Shufti.
Oh, two of you, said Jackram. Oh, well, that's all right, then.
I'll go, said Wazza. The Duchess has told me that I should.
Jackram looked down at Wazza's thin little face and watery eyes, and sighed. He turned back to Blouse. Let's get a move on, sir, shall we? We can talk about this later. At least we're headed to Knek, first stop on the road to hell. Perks and Igor, you take point. Maledict, yo! You scout on ahead. I hear ya. Good.
As the vampire walked past Polly, the world just for a moment changed. The forest became greener, the sky greyer, and she heard a noise overhead like wop-wop-wop-wop-wop, and then it was gone. Vampire hallucinations are contagious, she thought. What's going on in his head? She hurried forward with Igorina, and they set off again through the forest. Birds sang. The effect was peaceful, if you didn't know about birdsong, but Polly could recognize the alarm calls close by and the territorial threats far off, and everywhere the preoccupation with sex. That took the edge off the pleasure. It's hard to be an ornithologist and walk through a wood when all around you the world is shouting, "Bugger off, this is my bush, ah, the best thief, have sex with me, I can make my chest big and red."
"Polly," said Igorina.
"Hmm?
Could you kill someone if you had to?"
Polly came right back to the here and now. "What sort of question is that to ask anyone?"
"I think it's the sort you'd ask a soldier," said Igorina.
"I don't know. If they were attacking me, I suppose. Hurt them hard enough to keep them lying down anyway. And you?"
"We have a great respect for life, Polly," said Igorina solemnly. "It's easy to kill someone, and almost impossible to bring them back again."
"Almost?"
"Well, if you don't have a really good lightning rod, and even if you have, they're never quite the same. Cutlery tends to stick to them."
"Igorina, why are you here?"
"The clan isn't very keen on girls getting too involved in the great work," said Igorina, looking downcast. "Stick to your needlework, my mother keeps saying." "Well, that's all very fine, but I know I'm good at the actual incisions as well, especially the fiddly bits. And I think a woman on the slab would feel a lot better about things if she knew there was a female hand on the we belong dead switch. Though, I thought some battlefield experience would convince my father. Soldiers aren't choosy about who saves their lives."
"I suppose men are the same the world over," said Polly.
"On the inside, certainly."
"And, you really can put your hair back?" Polly had seen it in its jar when they'd been breaking camp. It had spun gently in its bottle of green liquid like some fine, rare seaweed.
"Oh, yes. Scalp transplants are easy. It stings a bit for a couple of minutes, that's all."
There was a movement between the trees, and then the blur resolved itself into Maledict. He held a finger to his lips as he drew closer, and then whispered urgently, "Jarl is dragging us." Polly and Igorina looked at one another. "Who's Charlie?" Maledict stared at them, and then rubbed his face distractedly.
"I'm sorry, sorry, it's... Oh, look, we're being followed, I know it."
The sun was setting. Polly peered over the rocky ledge, back the way they had come. She could make out the track, golden and red in the late afternoon light. Nothing was moving. The outcrop was near the top of another rounded hill. The rear of it became the floor of a little enclosed space, surrounded by bushes. It made a good lookout for people who wanted to see without being seen, and it had done so in the recent past by the look of the old fires. Maledict was sitting with his head in his hands, with Jackram and Blouse on either side of him. They were trying to understand, and not making much progress.
"So you can't hear anything?" said Blouse.
"No. And you didn't see anything and can't smell anything," said Jackram.
"Oh, no, I told you, but there is something after us, watching us."
"But if you can't," Blouse began.
"Look, I'm a vampire," panted Maledict. "Just trust me, okay?"
"I thought, Tharge," said Igorina from behind Jackram, "we Igors often serve vampires. In times of stress, their personal space can extend as much as 10 miles from their body."
There was the usual pause that followed an extended lisp. People need time to think.
"Stress," said Blouse. "You know how you can feel that someone's looking at you," mumbled Maledict. "Well, it's like that times 1,000. And it's not a feeling, it's something I know." "Lots of people are looking for us, Corporal," said Blouse, patting him kindly on the shoulder. "It doesn't mean that they'll find us."
Polly, looking down on the gold-lit woodland, opened her mouth to speak. It was dry. Nothing came out. Maledict shook the lieutenant's hand away.
"This person isn't looking for us. They know where we are."
Polly forced saliva into her mouth and tried again.
"Movement!"
And then it wasn't there any more. She'd have sworn there had been something on the path, something that merged with the light, revealing itself only by the changing, wavering pattern of shadows as it moved.
"Perhaps not," she muttered.
"Look, we've all lost sleep and we're all a little strung out," said Blouse. "Let's just keep things down, shall we?" "I need coffee," moaned Maledict, rocking back and forth.
Polly squinted at the distant pathway. The breeze was shaking the trees and red-gold leaves were drifting down. For a moment there was just a suggestion. She got to her feet. Stare at shadows and waving branches for long enough and you could see anything. It was like looking at pictures in the fire.
"Okay," said Shufti, who'd been working over the fire. "This might do it. It smells like coffee, anyway. Well, quite like coffee. Well, quite like coffee, if coffee was made from acorns, anyway."
She'd roasted some acorns. At least the woods had plenty of them at this time of year, and everyone knew that roasted, ground acorns could be substituted for coffee, didn't they? Polly had agreed that it was worth a try, but as far as she could recall, no one had ever, given the choice, said, "No, I will not touch horrible coffee any more. It's a long black ground acorn substitute for me, with extra floating gritty bits." She took the mug from Shufti and carried it over to the vampire. As she bent down, the world changed. Wop, 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 wop. The sky was a haze of dust, turning the sun into a blood-red disk. For a moment, Polly saw them in the sky. Giant, fat screws spinning in the air, hovering in the air, but drifting slowly toward her.
"He's having flash sides," whispered Igorina at her elbow.
"Flash sides?"
"Like someone else's flashbacks. We don't know anything about them. They could come from anywhere. A vampire at this stage is open to all sorts of influences. Give him the coffee, please."
Maledict grabbed the mug and tried to down the contents so quickly that they spilled down his chin. They watched him swallow.
"It tastes like mud," he said, putting down the mug.
"Yes, but is it working?"
Maledict looked up and blinked.
Ye gods, but this stuff is gruesome.
Are we in a forest or a jungle? Any flying screws? Igorina demanded. How many fingers am I holding up?
You know, that's something an Igor should never say, said Maledict, grimacing. But the feelings aren't so strong. I can suck it down. I can gut it out.
Polly looked at Igorina, who shrugged and said,
That's nice,
and motioned to Polly to join her a little way off.
He, or possibly she, is right on the edge, she said.
Well, we all are, said Polly. We're hardly getting any sleep.
You know what I mean. I've taken the liberty of being prepared.
Wordlessly, Igorina let her jacket fall open, just for a moment. Polly saw a knife, a wooden stake, and a hammer in neatly stitched little pockets.
It's not going to come to that, is it?
I hope not, said Igorina. But if it does, I'm the only one who can reliably find the heart. People always think it's more to the left than—
It's not going to come to that, said Polly firmly.
The sky was red. The war was a day away. Polly crept along just below the ridge with the tea can. It was tea that kept the army on its feet. Remember what's real. Well, that took some doing. Tonka and Lofty, for example. It didn't matter which of them was on guard, the other one would be there as well. And they were, sitting side by side on a fallen tree, staring down the slope. They were holding hands. They always held hands when they thought they were alone. But it seemed to Polly that they didn't hold hands like people who were, well, friends. They held hands tightly, like someone who has slipped over a cliff would hold hands with a rescuer, fearing that to let go would be to fall away.
Tea up, she quavered.
The girls turned, and she dipped a couple of mugs into the scalding tea.
You know, she said quietly, no one would hate you if you ran away tonight.
What do you mean, Oz? Said Lofty.
Well, what's there in Kinnick for you? You got away from the school. You could go anywhere. I bet the two of you could sneak.
We're staying, said Tonka severely. We talked about it. Where else would we go? Anyway, supposing something is following us.
Probably just an animal, said Polly, who didn't believe it herself.
Animals don't do that, said Tonka, and I don't think Maledict would get so excited. It's probably more spies. Well, we'll get them.
Nobody is going to take us back, said Lofty.
Oh, good, said Polly, backing away. Well, must get on. No one likes cold tea, eh?
She hurried around the hill. Whenever Lofty and Tonka were together, she felt like a trespasser. Wazza was on guard in a small dell, watching the land below with her usual expression of slightly worrying intensity. She turned as Polly approached.
Oh, Polly, said Wazza. Good news.
Oh, good, said Polly weakly. I like good news.
She says it'll be all right for us not to wear our dimity scarves, said Wazza.
What? Oh, good, said Polly.
But only because we are serving a higher purpose, said Wazza.
And just as Blouse could invert commas, Wazza could drop capital letters into a spoken sentence.
That's good, then, said Polly.
You know, Polly, said Wazza, I think the world would be a lot better if it was run by women. There wouldn't be any wars. Of course,